I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics' viral tubing mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CAUSEMETICS. .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this: talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
It's time for the Life Writing Podcast with your hosts, authors and screenwriters Stephen Barnes and Tanana Reeve Du. All about creating the project of your dreams while living a balanced artist life. Be the hero or heroine of your own story. Sponsored by LifeWritingPremium.com. Get ready to write for your life.
Welcome to the Life Writing Podcast, where married authors and screenwriter Stephen Barnes
and Tanana Reeve Du talk about writing during stressful times, breaking into Hollywood, and balancing life.
Every week, we'll share more tips on how to build a better life while you create your dream projects.
Even if it's only at the rate of one sentence a day, life writing is the application of the tools of writing to life and the tools of life to your writing.
Welcome, everybody. Yes. Heyo. Heyo. We saw Late Night with the Devil, so I'm thinking about the Johnny Carson era.
That was really excellent. That movie creeped me out more than any horror movie I've seen in the theaters in quite a while.
Isn't that a great feeling when you're driving home in the car and you're a little shaky?
Well, yeah, I guess the great feeling was about halfway through where I realized that somehow it had pried its way past my logic circuits. That something it had done had engaged itself directly with my emotions, and all the adult protective mechanisms were insufficient.
Wow. So, yeah, you know, since we're talking about what's going on, why don't we talk about what's going on? Hey! Yeah, so everything is,
I can already tell our guest is going to be great. She's in the green room having fun.
That's what we want. We want people to have fun, even when they're still in the green room. So
there are, by the way, wonderful guests, potential guests who are not necessarily on our wavelength, you know, that we're not going to do the best interviews with them and they're not going to be the best for our show. So part of the art of trying to do this show is finding the people who are going to kind of be in our groove so we can just kind of talk, you know, just kind of be ourselves. That's the thing that's the most fun for me at any rate.
Yes, well, exactly. Which is why usually we actually know our guests personally. In this particular case, this is our first meeting. So that's also fun.
Yes, it is.
But yeah, so we get a little bit of this and a little bit
of that. So what's going on in your life, sweetheart?
Well, I've started writing my next novel, excellent, which I'm sure my editor will be glad to hear. I think I mentioned earlier that when I was showing off that video of me dancing to Thriller, which, by the way, you can find on my Instagram page. I don't know where else I have that video posted. It's on YouTube and it's public. So if you go to YouTube and you look up Tananarive do Thriller dance, you can see it. And when my editor saw it, he was like, "Are you supposed to be writing a book?" Which to me was just a compliment in him recognizing how many long hours of practice I had to put in to learn how to dance to that video. So I've actually subscribed now to an internet virtual teaching, dance academy.
Yeah.
And my first lessons were on side gliding and back gliding, which we also know as the moonwalk. And I can already tell I am going to be all over this. I am going to finally figure out the moonwalk. The side glide is not bad considering I just started yesterday. I am going to be on TikTok if we're still allowed. I'm going to be dancing everywhere the next year. Y'all just wait. And other than that, I'm experimenting with little hair color because I have a TV appearance. Appearance tomorrow. I can't talk about it. I can never talk about things until they happen.
The price of fame.
If you know what? I'm just looking at my IMDb page, which I wish had way more writing credits, but I have 13 appearance credits on IMDb.
Pretty cool.
At what point do I get to call myself a television personality?
Today.
How many? Okay. I'm officially a television personality. So I'm trying, I had to go get a dress and get shoes and get my hair cut and just hoping they have a makeup artist because I can wing it, but I prefer not to. The only downside is it takes pretty much the whole day to do these tapings. So there's that. And I'm still doing grading, but I'll be done soon. The new quarter officially started today and I'm finishing the last quarter. Spring quarter is the worst. Shout out to anyone who's on the quarter system because
why do you think that is?
Because that gap between the winter quarter and spring quarter is so brief, you're literally still taking care of last quarter's business while you're getting ready to prepare the new quarter's students. And it's a little whiplashy. We only have 10 more weeks.
Right. And it's summer.
So what are you working on?
Yeah, life comes barreling at you. You better make sure that you're investing your days rather than just spending them. For me, as of about 4 days ago, I feel like I was completely over the COVID in terms of any kind of sickness.
Oh, but, hello. I don't know for sure that our audience do. Steve came back from Manila with COVID. I don't think we were talking about it.
No, we weren't talking about it because I didn't want people to be, to be upset. So, right. I was all vaxxed up and everything, but I almost certainly caught it in Taipei coming back from Manila. I was exhausted and jet lagged and overstimulated, neurologically. So there was a kind of a hole in my immune system that ordinarily protects me. But I was also glad that I was totally vaxxed up. It felt like flu used to feel. Not a bad case of flu, but there was something going on under the surface. It's like you're swimming on the surface of a pool and there are crocodiles underneath and you can feel them in the water. That stuff was not flu. There was no doubt in my mind that if I were not vaxxed up and not as healthy as I generally am, that would have been horrifying.
COVID cannot wait to do you great harm. You could feel idling, you don't want to rest? Oh, you don't want to take me seriously?
So I find that I still need over 9 hours of sleep. I'll wake up and my body will not feel like it's all together in the right way. And so, it's like roll back over, go back to sleep. The very worst moment of the whole thing was a moment when I woke up in the middle of the night at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Actually, I was having trouble going to sleep at night too, but I woke up maybe 2 o'clock in the morning and had a panic attack. Mm-hmm. This was a few nights after I got back from Manila. I could feel it. Something was wrong. I mean, something was really wrong. I was able to calm myself down and go back to sleep, but that didn't recur. But that was, like I said, another evidence that this was not the flu. This was serious. And I understood exactly why people, have died from it, people that I knew and loved. And it's good to be on the other side of that. So One of the things that happened is I immediately had to get into doing the rewrite on the Star Wars novel, which I thought I was going to be able to do in Manila. I figured I had this fantasy that I was going to work out all day and then work on my book at night. No, it was work out all day, go back to my room, watch Scooby-Doo, which was the only thing that I could find on television that wasn't in Tagalog, and then go to spaz out and wake up in the next morning and do it again. But I got that off. And I actually have the book plates that I have to sign, like 1,000 book plates that I need to sign for the limited edition.
Poor baby. You have to sign 1,000 book plates for your fans.
I know. I suffer so. It's so awful. And yes, the Star Wars Mace Windu novel.
The Glass Abyss.
Yes, The Glass Abyss. And I will say one thing about the book that I think I can get away with. And that is that when they asked me to do it, the money was good. You know, the time frame was a little shorter than I wanted. But I had one important question I asked them. And that was, can I give Mace Windu a romance? And they said, yes.
There it is.
So that's all I'm saying at the moment, that I promised them if they let me do that. I promise to give them my whole heart. I promise to really do everything in my power to deliver a fantastic Star Wars novel that was also a Stephen Barnes novel.
Yes.
And filled a gap that I saw in the Star Wars universe. So I got that off, and now I'm back onto the book that I'm writing with my mentor, Larry Niven. And I will be doing a lot of work on that today. I used Speechify. You know, it's like I'm finding one thing that's kind of interesting. I find it more difficult to get back into a book that or a project that I've been doing in the past. You know, I used to be able to jump right in with less resistance.
Yeah,
And that's, you know, that might be just a little bit of neurological rigidity. I mean, it's just like, you know, that could just be, you know, time, or it could be something else. I mean, my attention is scattered. But using Speechify to have Snoop Dogg read my book to me, read what I'd already done, was just wonderful. Or I could have had Barack Obama. I mean, I've got both voices.
You know, I have to shout out Tasha, who's like the only Black woman reader I've ever heard on any program. And I think it may be just a coincidence, but honestly, I feel like she's the best of every reader I've ever listened to.
That's Tasha. No coincidence.
Tasha is her name.
Different things.
Different expressiveness voices. Of her voice is incredible.
Well, I'll have to give that a shot. So
you know, a chance.
That I'll be doing that today, and I'm simultaneously, you know, keeping in the back of my mind trying to figure out this rewrite of Kundalini Equation. You know, there's a whole sequence that I've talked to you about that took place.
It's his first novel. He's revisiting it.
Yeah,
it was your first solo.
It was my fourth novel. It was my second solo novel.
Oh, sorry, I got all my facts wrong.
Okay, it's okay. I have a terrific idea that takes place during World War II that we won't go into very much that might not fit into the book. I'm keep looking at it, and it would, unless it fits thematically as well as in terms of the world building, I can't put it in there, even if it's cool.
All right. Well, you can trust yourself, and I trust you. You will know.
The instant I said that, I thought of a way that it might fit. But that's
of course. Of course you did.
Anyway, hey, enough of that. What I really want to do is to get to our guest.
I was going to say, I have a great idea.
Yeah.
Not for your book, but for this podcast. Let's bring on our guest. Aaron E. Adams is a first-generation Haitian-American writer and theater artist. She received her BA with honors in literary arts from Brown University, her MFA in acting from the Old Globe and University of San Diego, Shiley Graduate Theater Program, and her MFA in Dramatic Writing from NYU Tisch School of the Arts. These are all fine schools, people. And it's no wonder then that she's an award-winning playwright and actor. She had called New York City her home for the last decade, and she's the author of One of You and Jackal, which I read and could not put down. She also had a short story selected for Jordan Peele's Out There Screaming anthology. Please welcome to the show, Aaron E. Adams.
Hello.
Hey. So good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Someone who has been deeply invested in especially the Black horror community, let's say since the Horror Noir documentary came out on Shudder in 2019, I was an executive producer on that. And that was really the first time I felt a sense that there was a Black horror community. So I was pretty shocked when I came across Jackal and I hadn't seen it yet. I was like, oh my gosh, Erinne Adams, she came out of absolutely nowhere to me, came out of nowhere. And I just want to congratulate you on such a well-written and scary story. And I'll start with that piece, because there are many pieces to you. There's the theater piece, there's the horror writer piece, but you have really come into the public consciousness now as a horror writer. You were in, as I said, Jordan Peele's anthology. What is that like? And what drew you to horror in the first place?
Well, thank you. And yeah, it's a little strange. It's kind of like ending up in a house that you don't know, but is somehow perfectly suited to you. Like future right. You has come in and decorated the place. You're like, oh, I like this. This is lovely. So when it comes to horror, it's something that's kind of always been floating around, whether it's the kind of media I consume, the books I read, the movies I watch. But kind of like you said, I was so hesitant to like claim the identity of horror creator, horror writer for so long, because I just didn't feel like there was a space for me. And I didn't feel like very welcome, even though thankfully I found that to be the exact opposite case. But from the outside looking in, I didn't feel like there was this place for me. And I felt like, oh, yeah, I do these other things, but every so often I'll pick up a Stephen King book and be like, this is great. And I'm just like, no, there's a spot for you here. So like, I remember being a kid and reading like Goosebumps and Fear Street and reading Stephen King way too young and becoming slightly traumatized, but enjoying it.
Didn't we all?
I love horror movies, but I am a total wimp. I have to watch them at home with all of my lights on. But I really do. I really love them. And
I wonder whether or not horror writers don't actually have a lower threshold to fear than the average person. I think that they scare themselves more easily. I know you're thinking of me.
Yes.
Of course I am. You're the only horror writer I've ever lived with. So you're the one I've had a chance to observe up close. But I kind of compare that to things that I've heard people say. And I think that I would imagine the romance writers, you know, weep at romantic movies more easily. You know, that it's a matter of what is it that touches your heart.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I feel like in speaking, like in thinking about it, I've always been very sensitive to what scares me and then what scares other people. Because when it comes to writing horror, I only ever write things that actually scare me. I'm that person. I want to go and like sit in that uncomfortable feeling for as long as I can and see what's roaming around in there.
Absolutely. And in the case of Jackal, which is the one I've read, I know you have other work, so forgive me for going back to it. It's been out for a couple years now, but it will be new to some of our listeners. It seems to me that sort of the real world horror of that story is the disappearances of Black people, but Black women in particular, and how they can go so long unnoticed. And you kind of take that and turn it up to 11, as they say, and this is Spinal Tap. And like, this is a community where, I mean, I don't want to spoil it, but is it too spoilery to say that, let's just say a few young women have been vanishing from this community and nobody really seems to be paying attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean Jackal is very much wrapped around my own personal fear of if I go missing in this country, like only my family might care. Like not like it's just this fear that nothing would happen if I just vanished one day. And taking that and expanding that to a series of missing persons, which is this is all fake, obviously. I made all of this up.
But having
like a series of missing persons that feels intentional, and because there is this constant pushing away and sweeping under the rug and saying, oh, well, no, there she's a runaway, or oh, she had a boyfriend, or oh, there were problems at home. And I just hated that the more research I did, I just found more and more reasons with quotation marks as to why I could just vanish And that terrified me. So I wrote a book about it. And I like you said, I turned that anxiety all the as high as I could to have it be like, it's been happening for generations. And there is this strange story about the woods. The woods seem to may or may not be consuming these women and girls in a way that we can't really tell if it's a person or people, or if there is something in the woods, yes, that's causing this to happen. And I love that. I love when the thing in the woods may or may not be real. That is my favorite game to play.
Oh my God. And that is like, I will watch that movie every time. If it has woods, creek, river, I mean, that survival horror is my jam. So we are on the same wavelength about that. Absolutely. And it actually reminds me of something Jordan Peele told. It was either us or my class when he came to my class at UCLA, that this thing about Andre disappearing, the character played by Lakeith Stanfield, who gets abducted at the beginning of the movie. Look, if you haven't seen Get Out by now, that's on you. Okay. Yeah. So so he gets abducted, and he almost, I think he said he almost came to tears, sort of thinking about how easy it is for Black people, not just women, to just disappear. Like that's the reason the Armitage family said, yeah, this is how we're going to, or one of the reasons, this is how we're going to power this body snatching operation, because who's going to miss them? Mm-hmm. Who's going to miss them? So they got away with it for so long. And that's real. And that's scary. And I love, like you, taking my real life anxieties and churning it out into fiction.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Let's talk about your out there screaming story. And are you also in this new anthology that's coming out, The Black Girl Survives?
Yes, in this one. Yes, I'm also in there.
Yeah, so you're really finding that community, as you said, looking from the outside in, did not seem to be welcoming, has been super welcoming. I mean, you're being welcomed at a very high level, wouldn't you say?
Yes. No, I am so, so grateful. And like every time someone sends me like a kind email asking me to do something, I'm just like, yes, I'm so thankful that I've been able that not only have I been asked to contribute stories that people like, they like my strange, creepy, sad stories. I would say that for Out There Screaming, I wrote La Sirène, which is a kind of an eerie coming of age tale that's using Haitian mermaid lore to talk a bit about sisterhood.
I love that story, by the way. Love it.
Thank you.
As a sister, I you know, sibling stories are especially scary to me.
Yes. Yes. I have a sister, so I understand. And so it was really nice. I remember when I was first working on it and I sent it over and I was like, I really hope that they're on board with this. I hope that this, you know, fits the prompt, so to speak. And yeah, that story came out of, I just wanted a different kind of mermaid. I feel like I had, like, there was so frequently in my life, the stories that I had heard about mermaids like out in the world, and then the stories I'd heard about mermaids in my family and like in my community, and I was like, oh, these two things don't match up. And so for a long time I was like, oh, they don't match. But as I began writing more and telling stories, I'm like, oh, they don't match. That's exciting. I want to talk about that. I want to see what's in there.
That's your opening. And I would love to talk about that. You are first generation from Haitian immigrants. And I would love to talk about how you do think that background affects your storytelling, because you kind of have one foot in one world and one foot in the heritage of another world.
Yeah, I mean, it's something where for so long, identity, and it's still something that I'm grappling with, like it's, but for so long, I was like, oh, I don't feel like I'm Haitian enough to say that I'm Haitian. But then when I go out and think about my experiences being in America, I'm like, no, I was undoubtedly raised by a Haitian family. Like, there is no doubting when I go and look at my life experience and also like just how I view the world sometimes. So well, it is.
What's an example of that? I'm sorry.
An example.
To jump in
yeah.
There.
No. I'm trying to think of something like an example. Just a simple example of like having friends over for dinner. There is a certain amount of like, okay, your shoes come off at the door. You have to greet everybody by their names, by their titles. Like if someone's a doctor, call them Dr. So-and-so. And
oh, okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't come into my house calling my mother by her first name.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. No. We're not. There's just, I don't know, this, like there's not circumstance, what's the word I'm looking for? There's just a way of doing things. There's respect. There's respecting your elders. And there's a hierarchy, but it's also like the hierarchy is not inherently bad. It's just how it is, where it's like, if you're being younger, you depend on your elders. Your elders have their elders. Beyond that, you have ancestors. I think it would be reasonable
to say that not only is it not bad, but you find that behavior encoded into almost any culture worldwide that has not been damaged from the outside. That you're talking about the immigrant experience as opposed to the American descendants of slaves. So it's diasporic.
Yes.
Being able to compare the experiences of different branches of that diaspora is, I think, a legitimate and valuable contribution you can make. You have specialized knowledge that I think can enter into your work and elevate it in that sense, because you have knowledge of what happens when, you know, you find the same thing in people who came from the islands. It's a little different from people who came from Zimbabwe or Nigeria or whatever, because there you have a complete culture that goes back thousands of years. Whereas in Haiti, you have a culture that goes back hundreds of years. And a culture is created in isolation. That never happened in the continental United States. So you, what you're getting there is, I think, something that's very, very important and valuable. And I hope that you're encoding that. You're representing that experience in your work. That's valuable.
Yeah. And you said ancestors. That is a hugely important word. I mean, no matter what like spiritual beliefs are, I think that the cultural belief in ancestors, which is something you see among African Americans, but obviously it's at a very different level in Haiti, right? Is very, very important. How would you say that concept helps inform your either your writing or your life?
Oof, I mean, when it comes to the like concept of like ancestors and feeling like you're coming from coming from somewhere or people, it can feel like it informs my writing in that every story I make or every long form story I make, there is always a sense of history to it. I can't take the history out of it. I can't take this character's parents, grandparents, great grandparents out of the storytelling. There's a long thread for all of my characters. And when it comes to how I make stories, I always am looking at where they have come from previously, and then how that's going to inform them in the future. There is, I don't know how best to articulate it, but there's always an awareness of where someone has come from. And it's not just, you know, the given circumstances of a scene before you go in. It's like, because your mother was one way and then your grandmother was this way, this means that this character is going to react this way to this circumstance. And that's how I've always thought about character and how I've always thought about storytelling. And I never thought of it as anything out of the ordinary until, honestly, like American schooling and American storytelling, and people are asking me like, oh, why are you concerned so much about where this person is from? I'm like, well, because to me, it's really important where people are from. I know that's like the most word garbly.
No, that was a beautiful answer. We've literally never discussed this topic on this podcast. And I think you did a fantastic job with that answer. And yeah, and I feel that answer actually, because my family history is always walking with me. And history is a big part of a lot of my storytelling too, much to the surprise, I'm sure, of some of my former history teachers. And speaking of teachers in school, this is somewhat of an awkward segue, but one of the things I pride myself on at UCLA is taking students who are bound for law school or business school and showing them that they are really artists, because they get the chance to make a short film, or they get a chance to write a short story. And I'm telling you, I have literally had students like completely throw away their plans to go to law school and then, I want to work in the film industry, or I want to write scripts. Now, you were a theater major, which is not always the joy of our families as artists.
Yeah, so, to say the least.
How did you have to fight for your vision in the arts as a younger person? And what gave you the strength to carry that out?
Okay. So I'm very, I feel like, yes, I had to fight, but it was weighted in my favor because both my mother and my father had artistic dreams and pursuits that they chose not to pursue or to pursue the more stable careers of being a doctor and being a lawyer. My mother wanted to go into fashion design, and she still sews. She's a seamstress to this day, and like would make me dresses when I was a kid, and they're beautiful dresses. And my dad wanted to be a writer. Oh. And so when I showed up and was like, hey, you guys, I want to go into theater, there was the initial like, oh, I think this is a phase. Let her do her phase. But when she there was a long discussion. I remember when I was in high school, they're like, okay, you're going to do theater in high school. But when you get to undergrad, you need to start preparing for law school. You need to be a lawyer. And so for a while, there was a lot of bargaining happening. And then when I finally said like, hey, you guys, I think this is what I really want to be doing is having an artistic life. I think because my parents had those previous like artistic dreams, there was a bit of resistance, but the resistance thankfully was my parents entrenched themselves in all the knowledge they could access about theater. So like my mother was the one who studied everything you had to do to join the acting union. Oh, nice. And she would like quiz me on it.
Oh, wow.
Like, well, how many weeks do you need? How do you think you're going to get these points to get the weeks to get your card? Like, she just like entrenched herself in what knowledge that she could easily be accessed to her. And it was just like all those things you hear about immigrant parents, like, you know, wanting you to get the A+, wanting you to hold yourself to these super high standards. For better or worse, my parents just shifted that into art.
That is beautiful, Erin. That is, I'm sure there are a lot of people listening like, oh my gosh, I wish my parents had been like that. You know, when they decide you're going for it, that they get on the team with you and let's just power through this thing. You're going to make a living some kind of way. We're going to see to it. That is fantastic.
And they also, something I really do credit them is that they, how can I say this? Like the most diplomatically, they're like, we will, you know, we'll make sure that you do not starve in abject poverty, but also you have to make your own way. It's like, you have to figure out how to live in New York. You have to figure out how to have a day job. You have to figure out how to make all your ends meet, figure out how you're going to have health insurance, figure out how you're going to make the life you want. It's like, we will support you emotionally and somewhat, you know, financially, we'll make sure that you don't crash and burn, but you have to build for yourself.
So what you're talking about there is relatively typical. I mean, your parents obviously are fantastic parents, but it's relatively typical, far more typical of the immigrant experience of people who had the resources and understanding to get here in the first place and decided this was the place that would be better than where they were. They generally come with a plan. And part of that plan is first you survive, then you grow. And they were prepared to help you grow if you took care of your basic survival. They just wanted to make sure that you knew what was going on. But one of the things that you said that I think I would love to explore is the question of acting. People have often asked me, you know, should I go into an MFA program for writing, whatever? And I say, no, study journalism and acting. That between those two things, you have the skills that you need to both have the discipline and the linguistic skills and the ability to perceive and represent reality, but also the ability to write stories intrinsically. The characters, the creation of a character for acting has to do with getting inside the skin, whereas a lot of writers will manipulate their characters to move them through the plot without ever, and I do that in my first drafts, but then I have to go with each character and ask, given these actions, who would they have to be? And so it goes from external to internal, back to external. I would love for you to talk about three things that you learned in acting that you have been able to apply to your writing.
Oh, it's a quiz. Ooh, it's okay. Like your parents.
It feels familiar. So three things from acting. Well, number one, how to create characters and have them pursue their objectives. Like how do they, what tactics do they use? So like, I've definitely, how I, like, you know, how you break down a scene, I forget exactly what this is called, but like victory, obstacle, tactic, expectation. And so the victory is like, what do you want? The obstacle is what's standing in your way. Tactic is how do you get what you want? And expectation is what do you expect to happen? And so that's how I broke down every single scene acting through all sorts of mediums. And when it comes to writing scenes, that's how I start each character, especially if it's the character that's, you know, carrying the protagonist. I start with, okay, what do they want? What's in their way? What are they going to start doing? And what do they think is going to happen? And just let it go from there. That I will say also, the body. Something that I find that some writers forget, especially when it comes to writing for actors, like writing for TV, writing for theater, is that people have to do this. Whatever you're asking your characters to do, a body is performing it. So even if you're writing, you know, prose, a body, you know, in theory, in your imagination is doing it. So like, are they sweating? Are they cold? What did they eat that day? How is that sitting in their stomach now that, you know, the monster in the woods is getting closer? Are they going to throw up? There's just so much in the body you can't ever forget about that. From my experience as an actor, that's all you have is your body. So you're so used to being locked in there. And then I'd say the third thing that I can take directly from acting, into prose writing, storytelling. This is also a bit woo-woo and weird, so go with me, is the rhythm of a story. I did Shakespeare in my master's program at the Old Globe, and we ran these shows in repetition for 3 months. And those were the runs. We also rehearsed for 3 months. So I spent 6 months with 3 shows, which meant I heard them and I did them and I ran them and I felt them over and over and over again, 6 days a week for 3 months. You literally at that point can feel when a shift is coming in a scene. You can feel, you can hear when a play starts to go off in your head. When it's weird because like I would, you know, as an actor, it was just like, oh, my entrance is coming up because that thing just happened. But when it comes to me as a writer telling a story, I'll start either writing a scene, whether it's a prose scene or writing, you know, for TV or film or for theater. And I'll be writing along and I'm like, something has to turn at this point. Like we've been in this beat for too long. It has to turn now. And it's, yes, I can explain to you technically why it has to happen, but I just feel it in my body at this point because I've been sitting in stories for so long.
Look, I will be honest with you. I think the average English actor is better than the average American actor, not by anything innate, but because they all have to do Shakespeare. Shakespeare becomes a single focus that everyone, every single actor in that country has to master this or has teachers who have mastered it. So therefore it becomes a single standard. We don't have anything like that here, not even close. Tennessee Williams, and I don't know who the closest would come, but to have something that is at that high a level that everyone has to learn how to block, how to feel, how to say the speech, how to be in relationship with each other, I think it creates one of the things that is, you know, closest to some sort of objective standard for something that is hugely subjective. So I totally believe what you're saying. What you saw in it was the rhythm more than anything else. But I can promise you, you were absorbing a lot of other things at the level of unconscious competence, son.
And that, by the way, is a very intense acting experience. And I'm sure you've had many other intense acting experiences. I'm wondering when prose had the opportunity, or screenwriting, we can talk about that too. When did writing, period, have the opportunity to kind of weasel its way into your acting life?
It was kind of just like sitting right underneath everything all the time. I started like writing for fun as a kid. I have, like, my mother still has the notebooks on notebooks on notebooks. There's boxes of notebooks in my childhood home. And my first degree, my degree from Brown, is in literary arts. I did enough credits to accomplish a theater degree. So I technically, like, I have a double major, but my degree says literary arts. And I just kind of like always just kind of kept a hand on it, just kept it something that I did for fun, something I did to relax. And then it started to overtake everything when I found myself, I was in New York. I had an agent. I was going out like for between like 6 to 8 auditions and callbacks every week. I was getting callbacks. I was getting close to things and I was miserable. I was doing the thing. I was doing the thing I set out to do and I was not happy. And I just started writing more intently, more with more discipline, because it was a way of accessing my creativity on my terms. And honestly, in a way that this is going to sound a bit silly, but I could print out my stories to a page and I could touch them. And that was really important to me. As an actor, your work is, it exists in the air. It's ethereal. It's there and it's gone. As a writer, even if nobody publishes it, I can print out my story on a page and I can hold it. And I was at a point in my life where that was just really, really important to me. And so I just kept printing out more pages and making more stories I could hold. And then here we are.
When did you sell your first piece? Did you have a long series of rejections there as well as in acting, or was that a different experience?
It was a different experience. I will say I've definitely faced a lot of rejection as an actor. And I think that when I started to just shift my focus more over into writing, I let it be an experiment. I was like, all right, let's just try this and see what happens. Let's just submit here and see what happens. Who knows? And oh yeah, definitely that first year out, I got a bunch of rejections. I applied for like all these big writing programs. I applied for like playwriting groups. I applied for all this stuff. But I set out to collect the same thing way I did in acting. I wanted to collect rejections. My goal for my first year and a half of being a writer was to get 100 no's and like get 100 no's, because in there you might get a couple yeses.
What you just said is a core sign that someone is going to succeed. Look, I mean, in our own life writing program that we sell, no, we're not going to transition to sales at the moment.
One of the not at the moment.
You repeat the process of writing and submitting stories 100 times. You give yourself room to write 100 stories that you're constantly sending out. And no one who has followed that path has made it past story 23 before they sold. The average person gets to about story 10 before they sell, because they do not allow the anxiety to stop them from enjoying their process and having hope, rather than thinking, I'm going to write a story, I'm going to sell it, and I'm going to get rich, or I'm going to
win an award.
They're thinking, I'm going to write 100 stories. And they look at the process of creating and marketing their stories, of creating and sending it out, dealing with the anxiety and dealing with the fatigue and dealing with the excitement. And it all becomes part of a dynamic process. Those people, the people who say what you just said, are going to be the winners. And, you know, it might be possible for someone who is intuitive genius to be a winner, you know, who does have that sort of, I'm going to send out a story and win. But that is so rare. You're more likely to find unicorns.
Yeah.
So, you know, I want our listeners to focus in on that, because that was something that will save your career.
Absolutely. Oh my God, what a healthy attitude. And that's another thing coming from acting too, frankly, is that you have grown accustomed to rejection. And I would imagine, I mean, no rejection feels good, but I've always wondered with actors, it's so personal. Like, it's you and your face and your body that's being rejected, you know? And that has to feel way more personal than some papers you sent out.
I mean, it definitely can. I can remember auditions where I walked into the room and I was like, oh, it's not me, is it? Should I leave now? Like, I just got here. Let me do my 5 minutes and I promise I'll get out of your room. But with the collecting 100 no's, at least for me, it made it so much less personal. I'm like, no. Just give me my no so I can put it in my pile and I can keep going. And I also found myself applying for things that I didn't think I was ready for, because it became about just throwing a no in the pile, and which sounds a bit counterintuitive, but it, for me, it just helped. Like, I'm like, no, get to 100, then we can go back and assess. And because of that, like, I applied to Pitch Wars with Jackal, and I was revising that draft like for up until the moment I had to send it in. Like, I was frantically putting in punctuation and stuff. But I kept having this attitude of like, just send it in and hopefully maybe you'll get some feedback, like, or they'll just tell you no, and you could just throw it on the pile and you could just keep going and try again next year. And the next thing I know, it's like my story got picked. I got mentors to help me revise my story. I turned it into like a nice properly formatted, properly done manuscript. And then things just really started to take off from there. I think taking the personal out of it gave me, it let me reach for things that I would have like prevented myself from doing, like, oh, you've never written a book before. Maybe don't apply for that mentorship. Maybe write a few more books first and then try. And I'm like, no, just try it. The worst thing they'll tell you is no, which you already don't mind happening to you anyway. And the best thing will happen is you get it. It's a no for the pile, or you're going to get it and that'll be great. Both of these things are a win. Just do it.
I had a similar, you know, I didn't have 100 in mind, but I was very blessed with a high school English teacher who told me that the key to being a writer was to wallpaper my wall with rejection slips, which was sort of a visual image of the 100 rejections. So I literally would put them on the back of my door. Like, and like you would feel like a sense of pride. It's like, oh, there's 6 up there now. There's 8 up there now. It wasn't, I mean, it did get dispiriting after a while, I'm not going to lie, but... But that feeling of being on your way, and I love that empowerment you got for just sort of reaching for the stars, because it was just a part of what you knew the rejection process to be. That is beautiful. That is beautiful. So that, I mean, and I love that it's Jackal. That's the first thing I read by you. It was your baby. That was your first book. And you have another book, right? Yes. That's out or coming out.
It'll be out sometime early next year. It's called One of You, and it's focusing on at least how I want to deconstruct the American dream. It's following these two sisters who are both Haitian American. They live very different ideas of what the American dream is. Like, one has like a house and the husband and the kids and is like living that dream. The other one, she's very upwardly mobile. She's a lawyer. She lives in the city. But when their mother, the matriarch of the family, passes away unexpectedly, as with most funerals, all the family secrets start spilling out. And as more and more comes out, it threatens to rip away everything they've spent their lives and their parents have spent their lives working for in this country. And now they have to mitigate that before everything is gone.
Now that sounds like contemporary realism. Is it horror, or is there a little bit of horror, or is it completely
There's definitely like a speckling of horror, speckling of the little good, nice little dose of the supernatural in there.
Oh, good. Okay. I mean, either way, it would have been fine. You don't have to be a purist, you know. And also, by the time this podcast comes out, which is Sunday, it will be publication week for the Black Girl Survives in this one. So yes. I would love to hear about that experience, like what story you wrote for it. It's called YA, but I find with a lot of so-called YA horror, I'm like, why is this YA? This is just horror. What was that like when they approached you? How did it feel to be a part of it? And what, tell us a little bit about that story.
Yeah, so they approached me after reading Jackal, and I was like, oh, yes, I would gladly like to work on a story. And I very much, when I was thinking about what I wanted to write, wanted to use my theater background, and I wanted to write a theater ghost story. So my story is called Ghostlight. We're playing on the theater Ghostlight, that every theater has a ghost, and you have to do certain things to keep that ghost appeased. And so when the stage manager, Janine, inadvertently upsets this ghost, she is put through a very harrowing experience to just, you know, I think literally to get out of the theater that evening after shutting the show down for the night. It's playing off of theater ghostlight, and a nice big helping of Macbeth, because I could not help myself.
That's great. That's great. Well, everyone, you got to check it out. I did the foreword.
Yeah, you did.
And I promoted it on Instagram yesterday, and it got more than 1,000 likes. There is a real appetite for this. So check it out. It's publication week. The Black Girl Survives in this one. In this portion of the podcast, we usually talk about life, art, work, balance. I don't know.
Absolutely. When you get overwhelmed, what do you do to get back into balance?
Mm. I go outside. Most of the time it's getting outside, getting back into nature, which is interesting in New York City, but I still do it. I live near Central Park. Also just getting back into my body. Usually when I get stuck, it means that I'm somewhere in like a tiny room in my head and I can't get out. So walking, exercising, going into like into nature in Central Park. Also, I would say, at least for me, being a writer demands that I live my life. So I go back and I engage with life. Sometimes that means like seeing my friends. Sometimes that means going and visiting my family. It's reminding myself that I am a human and I have human experiences. And that for me, if I'm really blocked, like that will get it out.
Are you writing full time or are you also balancing that with work?
I'm currently writing full time. I'm attempting to continue to write full time. That comes with its own, you know, set Look, of difficulties.
Good luck.
Thank
you. I did it for 15 years. It was great to be my own boss. I have to have a rule that I had to be dressed by noon. That was my big rule. But I do teach now at UCLA, and I know a lot of writers do teach and directors do teach. So keep that up as long as it's comfortable. But I find that having a job that I like can actually be a nurturing part of my writing practice, especially writing teenagers. Teaching helps me in terms of engaging with that youthful voice because I am way so not a teenager in scripts, mostly, frankly. And I do want to ask you a little bit about your Hollywood experience. Have you had opportunities to try to adapt your own work, or are you writing spec scripts? What's your screenwriting like?
I'm very much in like the baby phase. Well, not intermediate phases of it. I mean, I have a degree. So I have a couple of original pilots. I have a very ill-fated spec that is living in a drawer where it needs to live. But I haven't had the opportunity to adapt my work just yet. I would very much like to in the future. And I am in that, you know, strange catch-22 process where it's like trying to be staffed. How do you get staffed? Well, you have to be staffed previously. Okay, how do you get staffed? So I'm like in that strange loop of just trying to get my foot in the door. And I'm very, you know, grateful that at least in my experience, I've had, again, just a couple of meetings here and there that at least the rooms I'm obviously meeting for are either hybrid or digital, or if they would need me to go to LA, I'd have enough notice to like be able to pack up and like head out there. So yeah, I'm just like, I'm in my beginning stages. I'm just trying to stay feisty, getting into a room.
At your phase as when I was your age, you know, but at your phase of writing, I didn't even know how to conceive of how to break into a TV writer's room or that thought hadn't even crossed my mind. So as far as I'm concerned, you're already ahead of the game. And you're right, you've come at a good time in that, unfortunately, because of COVID, but fortunately for people who don't live in LA, there are a lot more hybrid rooms. I mean, frankly, there weren't that many hybrid rooms back in the day. You had to live in LA. And while it's still a good idea, it's not as necessary. I mean, we worked in a room last year for Crystal Lake, where one of the women was in London. You know, one of the guys, the first couple of weeks was at home because he was sick and, you know, getting over COVID. So hybrid rooms can create a lot of opportunities for new television writers. And you hear that audience, Erin E. Adams is available to staff. And you hear she has a great ethic and a great attitude about the arts. And I think, Steve, that might be a good segue for us to talk about Life Writing Premium, because she really does so epitomize what we teach in our digital download Life Writing course, which is a lot like our podcast, by the way. We have lectures on craft issues, we have advice. It's either recordings like when I was at the Geneva Writers Conference and I did lectures on characterization, or various lectures Steve has done. You get one digital download every week. It's like an accountability partner. And we like to say that no matter what level you are, whether you're still like Erin was in the beginning, where you're collecting your nose, or you've already published a few stories or maybe a book and you're just trying to reinforce your writing practice, check out Life Writing Premium. Steve, did you want to say anything about it? It's actually your flagship. You've been teaching life writing since before I met you.
Yeah, well, I have. But I think that it really became something special. I mean, I always felt it was something special, but it became something I think, singular when we realized that we wanted to do it together, but that we didn't always agree on everything. And I remember saying, we don't have to agree.
Right.
That we make the fact that we have different points of view on this one of the selling points, that there's your position on it and there's my position on it. And it helps people to see that there are principles underneath that if you can resolve the duality of the way we look at these things, what you're seeing is that there is a path, and every writer has similarities about how they walk that path, but every writer also has differences. We are about right. taking people who are willing to work, willing to manage their expectations, willing to write 100 stories in order to get published. If you've got that, if you've got the heart for that, if you
and you can do one sentence a day, we're not kidding.
That's
one
right.
One sentence a day it is starts the minimum buy-in.
Just one sentence a day. If you will do that, we can get you all the way there. And I am very, very proud of that program. We also on Saturdays have a totally free a Zoom meeting that is starting to be more and more about writing that you can get onto at TananarivList.com
or StephenBarnesList.com.
And we meet every Saturday and we talk about life and creativity and health and energy, the things that you're going to need to have a foundation of kind of sanity and health to move forward so that you can. I remember one writer came to my very first signing and he gave me his business card and it said freelance hack and literary mechanic, and he was dead of alcoholism within a year. That the arts can be rough and they can have invisible costs, and we have 100% sympathy, 100% empathy. If you want with the person who wants to learn how to write or move their writing career forward, it is 100% honest. We're talking about exactly what we've experienced and seen and have used ourselves and have taught our students. And we believe that if you will give it a chance, if you will try it for 3 months, you will see what it is that we're doing and you will see the results in your work. LifeWritingPremium.com. It's our flagship program. And we're totally proud of it.
Yeah. And if you've been listening for a while, maybe this is your sign. It's time to sign up. You've listened to the podcast long enough to know who we are and what we're about. It's time to sign up for the program. At the very least, the URLs that Steve gave you earlier are for our mailing list. So it's TananarivList.com or StephenBarnesList.com gets you those links to come to our live Saturday Zooms. Like, really, we do that every Saturday. We do live Zooms with you all if you come on in. Erin B. Adams, thank you so much for being on the Life Writing Podcast. Where can people find you on the socials or if they want to reach out?
Yeah. So my handle is I am E.E. Adams on all the things, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok. And my website is www.erineadams.com. And thank you so much for having me.
Oh my gosh, you've been an incredible guest. Thank you so much for being on the Life Writing Podcast. If you're not inspired, audience, I don't know what more will inspire you. Go on and be the hero.
Check your pulse.
Go on and be the hero or heroine in your own story.
The hero in the adventure of your lifetime.
Bye-bye, everybody. I love a great show.
You've been listening to the Life Writing Podcast. Join us next time for more conversations about creating the project of your dreams. For more information, go to LifeWritingPremium.com and get ready to write for your life.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.